Three,
Three,
two,
two,
one.
one.
About 3 hours late, that
Oh,
clap.
God. I forgot about the hand clap. I
It was
forgot
like,
that,
oh,
Lily.
what is, oh, this is something I'm supposed to do here. What is it? Oh, yeah.
That's so impressive. Hello, and welcome to We Are History, the less than serious history podcast. Angela's laughing at my useless introduction timing. We have to clap and count down, and I just forgot to clap.
I
And it's
think
just.
our listeners are now aware because we fuck it up so often.
It's a lot to think about.
It is, John. It is sort of multitasking in a way, isn't
That is a lot. I mean, just counting down backwards from five is a challenge for
it?
me. Today on wearehistory.pod.com.net, we're going back to the Second World War.
We
And
are.
Angela's going to lead on this one.
I
This
am.
is She's read the book and everything.
Today, we are going to be talking about something called Operation Mincemeat, which, John, is not about my challenges to find the ingredients for mince pies outside the Christmas season.
Every week we do this sort of like, whoa, tell the listeners what we're listening to. It's written on the podcast. Everyone knows what we're talking
Yeah,
about.
it's true.
It's
It's not a
like,
surprise,
oh,
is
this
it?
big reveal,
Guess what's
everyone.
coming, guys? Oh, yeah, no, we've already, A, it's the title, and
And
B, we've
it's
tweeted about
described.
it.
And it's described.
So,
So, the
yeah.
amazing surprise.
Anyway, you know what we're talking about.
But they don't know all the detail about it, Angela. And this is a
No.
very, very quirky plan from the Second World War that
It
you're going
is.
to tell us all about this week.
I am. It's a slightly deranged World War II operation, John. And I'll tell you what it involves. It involves a corpse being washed up carrying strategic documents to be found by the enemy. And it is
Right.
an operation that, it could be said, helped change the course of the war.
They
So
always
it's an
say that, though,
important
don't they?
operation. They do. Like,
They never go, well, it made a bit of difference, but it's probably a lot of
actually, it did
effort.
fuck all. But no, they never say that. I've sworn twice already, John. We haven't even
That's
started
terrible.
yet. It's terrible.
So where are we talking about, Angela?
Operation Mincemeat takes place in 1943. So
Okay.
we're getting towards the end of the war. In November 1942, the British Eighth Army have vanquished Rommel's Africa Corps, right? And
Yes, come
they've done
on.
it. El Alamein's happened. The Allies control the coast of North Africa now, from Casablanca to Alexandria. And the next move on
Yeah.
the Allies list is to attack what Churchill called Europe's soft underbelly, right?
It's
So they're
soft
now. So
underbelly.
it's quite good, wasn't
This is actually something he did in World War One, wasn't it? When it was a disaster and he attacked Gallipoli. So he thought the same thing again of, I think he was so influenced by the campaign of Wellington in Spain against Napoleon that he really was convinced that the soft underbelly was the way to change the course of the war.
What that meant in real
Yes.
terms is either attacking Sicily to allow the invasion of continental Europe through Italy, which
Yes.
obviously is an Axis power at that
Yes.
time,
Yes.
or to go via Greece to the Balkans, where they can trap the German forces on the Eastern Front,
Yes.
sort of between the British and American invaders and the Soviets.
Yes.
So they had these two options. And at the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, the planners decided that they're going to invade Sicily.
The
That's the option.
Casablanca Conference, was that
The
held in Rick's
Casablanca
Bar?
Conference. That's right, it was.
In all the bars and all the
Imagine
gin
all
joints in all
the
the world, you had to walk into mine.
work.
What was Stalin's bogey impression like? I wonder. Well, Sicily was so close. If you look on the map, it's so close to Tunisia, and it's the
Yeah.
narrowest crossing. And it was bleeding obvious it was going to be Sicily. So they had to do
Yeah.
something, didn't they?
Well, exactly. So the operation to invade Sicily is called Operation Husky,
Okay.
because people from Sicily have famously gravelly voices, I think. And it was the obvious choice. And this is a problem, right? Because if it's an obvious choice to the Allies, it's going to be obvious
Yes.
to the Germans, right? So the Allies have to make Germany believe that their intention is not to attack Sicily at all.
How are
Right?
they going
Sounds
to do
simple.
that, Angela?
Well, John, deception is obviously a huge part of wartime strategy, right? Half
Yeah.
the battle is making your opponent think you're going to do something other than what you're actually going to
Yeah.
do. And
Yeah.
there's a whole department dedicated to plans of deception. And this department is called the London Controlling Station, which is
Oh, it's
nice and
not very
vague.
glamorous, is it?
It's not
Well,
very glamorous, but they can't really call it the Department for Hoodwinking the Germans,
oh,
can
I
they?
suppose
It's a bit of a giveaway.
it was a trick of itself. They'll give it such a sort of dull name. I'm going off to the London Controlling Station, dear. Sort of place that John Major would work. The impressions are pouring out today. I've done Churchill, bogey, John Major. I'm on fire today.
John. Oh, are you auditioning for something? Is
Yeah, no, I'm hoping to be
it's
the new Rory
range,
Bremner.
guys. Now, the London Controlling Station is headed by one Johnny Bevan, who's
Johnny
an old
Bevan.
Etonian. We're sort of entering this world that I love now of posh blokes in intelligence. I don't know why I love it, but I do. So Johnny Bevan is in charge of what's called Operation Barclay, and that is specifically the operation of deception to try and get the Germans to think they are definitely not going to invade Sicily.
Right, okay.
So this is where the idea for Operation Mincemeat comes about. Now, okay, we go back to the beginning of the war. Ooh. 1939, there's a man called Admiral John Godfrey, and he's the director of naval intelligence. And he sends out, he circulates a memo, which becomes really famous. It's called the Trout Memo. And he writes it, John, with his PA.
Okay.
Do you know who his PA is, John?
His PA was Ian Fleming, the famous or future author and James Bond and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So their Absolutely. Idea was to put a flying car over Sicily with That's the children right. to catch the child catcher.
There is a thesis to be written on the amount of people intelligence that end up as novelists, because it's pretty much all of them end up as, I suppose, because what they do was so mad and so novelistic. Anyway.
So Ian Fleming, so they reckon this was this memo, though it was credited to Admiral John Godfrey, the bloke working for him was Ian Fleming, and he said this mission should be shaken, not stirred.
That's right. Yeah. It's called the Trout Memo because it compared the deception of an enemy in war time with fly fishing. He writes in the memo, the trout fisher casts patiently all day and he frequently changes his venue and his lures. And the memo goes on to list 54 ways that the enemy like trout, 54 ways to leave your lover.
54 ways that the enemy is like a trout. The enemy swims upstream and lays his eggs in gravel.
No, John. It's 54 ways that the enemy can be fooled. So suggestion number 28 in the trout memo is titled A Suggestion, brackets, not a very nice one, close brackets.
Okay.
And it's based on a novel by someone called Basil Thompson, who, interestingly, ex-prison officer and also interrogator of Mata Hari. We don't have time for that.
Right.
So this is what's written in the Trout Memo. This suggestion is that a corpse dressed as an airman with dispatches in his pockets could be dropped on the coast, supposedly from a parachute that's failed. Says, I understand... There's no difficulty in obtaining corpses at the Naval Hospital, but of course, it would have to be a fresh one. Now, this idea of planting fake documents for an enemy to find is nothing new, and it's called the haversack ruse, because there was an incident in World War I in Gaza where a British spy took a bag with false documents in, he smeared it in horse blood, rode out into no man's land until they started shooting at him, at which point he slumped forward, deliberately dropped the bag, and then rushed back behind British enemy lines.
Okay.
And then they started a fake sort of frantic search for the bag so that the enemy thought there's something important in that bag.
Right, wow. So you would have thought the Germans were looking out for this a little bit.
Yeah.
So you've got to make it convincing, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And they would have been doing the same thing. You know, deception, like I say, big part of war.
Remember our spy pigeons episode, Angela?
Exactly, yes.
Germans were sending back pigeons with false information.
Yeah.
Do listen. It's a good one.
There was another precedent to this, which wasn't a ruse at all. A seaplane had crashed off the coast of Cadiz in Spain. And Cadiz is said to be a bit of a hotbed of German spies.
Oh, you mean Cadiz?
Cadiz. So we'll come back to Spain in a second. But
all right.
Everyone in this crash was killed, including Paymaster Lieutenant James Haddon Turner.
Okay.
Now, he was a courier who was carrying these top secret documents. And there was also a French agent who was a special operations executive.
Blimey. High risk.
Both their bodies got recovered and both of them had documents with sensitive information. And it turned out that the English lieutenant, his documents weren't passed on to the Germans, but the French guys were.
So Spain, of course, at this point was officially neutral in World War II.
Technically.
But they're a bunch of fascists, weren't they? Because we did another podcast about that as well. The Spanish Civil War. Franco, he was a bit of a Nazi as well, let's be honest.
Sorry, that went down the wrong way.
You're right there, Angela, you're coughing.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm coughing at Franco being a Nazi.
You're so shocked. I thought he was one of the nice guys.
Not Uncle Frank.
So it was a clever way of doing it, really, because if you sort of drop a British airman full of documents, you know, in Berlin, it's like, well, that's obviously trying a bit too hard. But to give it to an officially neutral country where you thought they would break their neutrality by giving the secrets to the Germans, that was a clever way of making the Germans think it was an accident.
Absolutely. I mean, it had risks because not everyone in Spain is pro-fascist, as we know from the Spanish Civil War episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had to ensure that these papers got into the hands of people that would pass them on to Germans. So now let's go into this lovely world of British intelligence that I've got a bit of a soft spot for. And I'm going to introduce you to the two main players in this, John.
Yes.
First of all, you had Charles Christopher Cholmondeley.
Cholmondeley
is 6'3". He's got thick glasses. You see pictures of him. He's really gangly. He's all arms and legs and a bit awkward. And he would have loved to be a flying ace in the RAF, the sort of same way that you'd love to play for Fulham, John. It was never going to happen.
What do you mean? I may yet.
He was a flight lieutenant in RAF intelligence, and he'd been seconded to MI5 during the war.
They always have names, don't they? Like, that are spelled differently to how it's pronounced. It's always like Farquharson and sort of...
Oh, yeah. Cholmondeley is spelled Cholmondeley. But it's Cholmondeley.
I bet he went to Magdalen College, you know. Yeah. It's that sort of thing, isn't it? So they could correct you. Mr. Cholmondeley, can we have a Mr. Cholmondeley, please?
It's Cholmondeley, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry, do continue, Angela. Particular bugbear of mine about posh pronunciations.
So he's now working for MI5, and he is the secretary of the top secret 20 committee. Now, the 20 committee, John, written down, it is the XX committee.
Oh, they're still speaking Latin back then. This is a long
time ago.
They're
still speaking Latin. So it's Roman numerals, obviously, for 20. But it was a pun, you see, John, because the XX stood for double cross.
I'm not laughing, Angela.
You're not laughing. Okay, fine. It wasn't the best joke, but, you know, they tried.
Oh, that's very clever.
It's difficult times. It's wartime.
XX is double cross, so we call it 20 committee. Yeah, yeah. Try closing the comedy store with that gag. We'll see how you get on.
The job of the 20 committee was to coordinate the intelligence they got from B1A. Now, it gets all confusing with these intelligence departments, so don't worry about it. But B1A was the department that ran captured German spies. So when German spies were captured in Britain, they would either be imprisoned or they would be used as double agents and would be used to pass misinformation back to the enemy. Right. And the job of the 20 committee was to sort of coordinate the intelligence that these double agents were providing them with. In October 1942, so this is just after this dead bloke's washed up in Cadiz and they've realised that Spanish agents might pass documents on to the Germans, Cholmondeley presents to the 20 committee this plan called the Trojan Horse. Okay. His plan is, he says, a body is obtained from one of the London hospitals. Normal peacetime price, £10, apparently.
Okay.
It would be dressed in a uniform of suitable rank, lungs filled with water and documents put in inside pocket, and the body would be dropped by coastal command aircraft at a position where currents will wash it ashore in enemy territory.
Wow.
And of course, this is a good plan in some ways, because what a dead body can't do is get tortured or be turned as a double agent, right? So John Masterman is the chair of the 2020 committee. He thinks this is a brilliant idea. John Masterman.
John Masterman. So his chair, has he got a big black chair?
Oh, dear.
I've got to do the gags, Angela.
That is your job, John.
John Masterman. Okay.
So he's the chair of the 20 committee and he thinks it's a great plan, right? And he thinks Operation Barclay's happening, this operation to deceive the Germans about Sicily. Let's use this plan in it. Now, because in the plan, the corpse is planned to arrive by sea, it'll be under naval control, this operation. Right. And the representative of naval intelligence on the 20 committee is a dashing chap called the Honourable Ewan Montagu.
Wow, now, he's another great name.
A brilliant name. He is probably the most important person in this story. He is a really well-renowned lawyer, relishes fighting authority, that sort of lawyer.
Right.
He's from a rich Jewish banking family. His father was a peer, Baron Swathling.
Baron Swathling and Cholmondeley and Montagu.
Absolutely.
No one has names like that anymore. You don't get out of the pub and go, so this is Baron Swathling, this is Ewan Montagu, this is Cholmondeley.
Well, not in the pubs we go to, John.
No, maybe.
If you go to a gentleman's club in Mayfair, possibly.
I suppose so.
Interestingly, and this is a little side note, his brother, Ewan Montagu's brother, was Ivor Montagu, who was a communist filmmaker and tennis table champion and Soviet spy. But that's another story.
They have such interesting jobs, don't they?
Another little interesting aside, Ewan and his brother Ivor played table tennis together, and they, in fact, came up with the name table tennis for ping pong. Yeah, there you go. So you've got this dashing chap. I imagine he smokes a pipe and sounds like Leslie Phillips.
I'm sure you're right.
He's a married man, but his wife has gone to America with the children because they're from a Jewish family. And so if Britain was invaded, which it was likely, they wouldn't have fared very well under the Nazis. And he was really good at his job in naval intelligence. And he rose up the ranks and eventually had his own subsection of the department, which was called Section 17M for Montague. I should say, by the way, the book I've read on this is Ben McIntyre's book called Operation Mincemeat. Do read it, because it is full of twists and turns and tangents that we haven't got time for, and it reads like a brilliant novel. So, the plan. It's decided that they would get a body.
Yeah.
They would transport it to waters where it would wash ashore in southern Spain.
Pedalos.
Yeah, probably. They also decided on Spain, not just because it was likely to get passed on to the Germans, but because they were British, they just assumed that Spanish doctors wouldn't be very good at doing post-mortems. They were wrong in that, but that's what they assumed.
I suppose they thought that with Spain being neutral, they wouldn't have been as rigorous as Germans, who were determined to find out for their war effort whether or not this was a genuine airman. I suppose that might have been thinking, but or maybe they just thought they were Southern European lazy types.
Well, there was a... We'll come on to it in a minute, but there was a pathologist who was very much that Spanish doctors aren't up to it, they're not as good as us.
Oh really? Okay.
And so they would never do as good an autopsy as we would do. Like, they can't make a decent cup of tea in Spain, you know, that sort of Brexity thinking.
Okay.
First things first though, John, what do you need for this operation?
A corpse,
right? And you'd think wartime, got to be 10 a penny.
Yeah.
Turns out Chomley was wrong. You couldn't get one off the shelf for tenner.
Well, I suppose you've got every family that's lost somebody, you'd have to consult them and ask them, and then they might talk, so they might be proud and want to say so.
Even in wartime, every corpse has to be accounted for.
Yeah.
And the corpse needed to meet certain requirements. So it had to be a male body of military age. It had to have no obvious injuries or infirmities, apart from the infirmity of being dead.
That is a big one.
Which is a big one, because it had to look like it had drowned, right? So you couldn't have it with a big stab wound in the back.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So you've got to have it. It's got to have died of something, not drowning, but
something that could be disguised as drowning. This is where they consult this senior Home Office pathologist, who's called Sir Bernard Spilsbury.
You're making these names up now, Angela. Sir Bernard Spilsbury. Oh.
John, you wait for what's coming up next, mate. It gets so much better, the names.
Okay.
So Bernard Spilsbury was famous for identifying the remains in Dr. Crippen's cellar.
It all links up.
And his verdict was that they should find a drowned man and float him ashore in a life jacket.
Oh, yeah. Well, you do that then, mate. That's your idea. You do that. You organise that then, and I'll do the Christmas rota.
Well, they toyed with the idea of doing, as they called it, doing a Burke and Hare, robbing.
No, Burke and Hare ended up killing people, didn't they? So,
well, they did in the end, yeah. I think they meant they'd rob rather than that they'd actually go that far. But eventually they approached the coroner of St. Pancras, who was a man that Ewan Montague was acquainted with. And his name, John, was the best name in the book. His name was Bentley Purchase.
That's brilliant.
Bentley Purchase, which I think makes him the opposite of Nick Ferrari.
Oh, very good.
See
very
what
good.
I've done there?
Bentley Purchase, but Nick Ferrari.
So Bentley Purchase, he's sort of a jolly coroner. Apparently he was very funny, had a sense of humour. When he would give people directions to the coroner's court, he would always add at the bottom, an alternative means of getting here, of course, is to get run over.
Again, it's not closing the store.
He's been known, old Bentley Purchase, to help intelligence services in the past. Like, for example, when an Abwehr is the German intelligence service, when an Abwehr spy killed himself in London by sticking his head in an oven, Purchase gave the verdict on the death certificate as a heart attack and things like that. So he's done bits and bobs of slightly underhand things. So he agrees to give Montague a tour of the mortuary, see if there's anything suitable in stock.
We'd like to have a look at our range, sir. Pulling out the drawers, this might suit you, sir. This is a this is a dead old lady who lost her head in a tram accident. No, that's not really what I'm looking for. Who did they get? Who is the hero of this story?
This is the saddest bit of the story. His name was Glyndwr Michael. He was a Welshman. Right. And it's pretty fair to say, John, he had a shit life. A really shit life. He was born in 1909 in the Welsh colliery town of Aberbargoid.
Okay, well, it's pronounced.
Thank you. Did you see I wrote it phonetically in my notes?
Very good.
I had to Google how to pronounce that. But
you do your research. Credit to you. You do your research, Angela.
His mother was illiterate. She'd been married twice. His father, her second husband, was a Welsh Baptist coal miner who had syphilis. He'd passed syphilis on to his wife, and Glyndwr was likely born with congenital syphilis, which gave him a lot of problems. He had what we would now call learning difficulties. He certainly had mental health problems.
Yeah.
His father was physically very ill from working down mines and was also mentally ill from the syphilis. His father tried to stab himself in the neck once.
I think his mother took her own life as well, I think.
I don't know if she took her own life or if she died of a stroke.
Right.
But certainly after his father died, the family were destitute. They lived on handouts.
Yeah.
His sisters and brother, they moved away and had families of their own. So it's just him. He wasn't well enough to work properly. His mother died in 1940, lost the only emotional support he had. So he was homeless, destitute, mentally ill. And a country at war that didn't care.
Poor Glendreyer. But he's going to serve his country in a way he can never imagine.
He is. So it's not clear when he came to London. At some point he came to London. Bentley Purchase said that quite often people came to London to die because they thought their death would go unnoticed and they could just sort of blend in London. So quite often people came to London with the intention of killing themselves. We don't think that was the case with Glinda or Michael. He stayed in London in common lodging houses in 1942, but he also was sleeping rough and he spent some time in what was then called a lunatic asylum.
Okay.
And on the 26th of January 1943, they found his body. He'd ingested rat poison. It was assumed he took it deliberately, but there's also a chance that he, remember, this man is, you know, he has learning difficulties. He's not, and he was hungry.
Yeah,
and there's a chance that he ate some rotting leftover food that was laced.
I read that he ate some bread that had this rat poison paste spread on it.
Mm.
So it might have been a suicide, but it might have just been a really unfortunate and horrible way to die. But a way to die, because it's phosphorus poisoning, so
yes,
it's slow
right.
and it's takes you a few days, but it's not that detectable. Is that right? Is that why it was quite a useful death for the security services?
It took him 2 days to die. It's a slow death. Phosphorus poisoning with a horrible bit in the middle where apparently you feel fine, which is quite sad, isn't it? And then your organs fail and that's that. He was 34, unloved, not missed. And when he arrived at St Pancras Morgue...
All the posh people are like, splendid, what excellent news, hurrah!
Bentley Purchase, he phones up Ewan Montague and says, I think your candidate's arrived. And they kept him in cold storage until they were... ready for him. Purchase did a swift inquest. There'd usually be an autopsy in a poisoning case, but obviously they didn't bother here. He was just listed as a lunatic labourer of no fixed abode.
Blimey, it's not what you want on your gravestone, is it, really?
It's not, is it? And like you say, John, phosphorus is not readily traceable after a period of time, unlike other poisons.
Yeah.
And there were signs, like yellowed skin and gastric burns, but they were harder to pick up. And the yellowed skin could be explained away just by decomposition or whatever.
Okay.
So they've got their body, John. They've got their corpse, but time's now of the essence because this body is starting to do what bodies do. It's starting to rot.
Oh, no.
And they can't freeze it. Because if they freeze it and then thaw it out for the operation, the freezing's going to have damaged all the soft tissue. So that's going to show.
Right.
So they keep it in a fridge at the morgue at 4 degrees.
Move the oven chips.
Yeah, that's it. Get your yogurt out the way.
Out of the way, yeah.
And,
there's less food then because of rationing. So I suppose there was room in the fridge.
And Purchase said this body needs to be used within 3 months.
Oh,
ideally.
That's just health and safety thing. You don't take any notice of those days.
So a week after his death, Chumley and Montague, they present a draft of what is now called Operation Mincemeat to the 20 Committee, and it's agreed that they should try and go ahead.
Yeah, I read that the name Mincemeat was just taken off a list of names for operations. Somebody's job was to sit down and write, and what else can we call an operation? Operation Thursday, Operation
Love Janet. Strict rules on code names. Because Churchill said you had to make sure there was nothing too sort of fluffy or nice because you didn't want to be, oh, my husband died in Operation Bunny Hop or whatever, you know.
Operation I Really Fancy Janet from Accounts. That would have given away too much information.
So code names were selected from a list, but Ewan Montague selected Mincemeat because he thought it was close to dead meat.
It's a bit grim, isn't it?
Grim.
It's a mincemeat.
Yeah.
It's like the human corpse, mincemeat.
When I read this, I have nothing but sort of sadness about this poor man who, but we have to remember they're in wartime intelligence and it's tough, right? And they're trying to win a war.
Yeah.
So they're just getting on with it. And they're...
Bigger things at stake, Angela. You can't get all emotional about Glendier here.
Right.
We've got a war to win. Come on.
Exactly.
Put yourself together.
So the corpse needs a backstory, right?
Oh, yes.
It can't just float the corpse. It needs to be good because the Germans aren't just going to go, oh yeah, he looks like a naval officer. We'll accept that. They're going to check up on
So they need some writers. This is bring on the writers.
This is what I would have been doing.
I would have been creating backstory, motives, a love life.
I think, John, you and Ewan Montague would have gotten very well. I think you would have enjoyed his part in this, which goes insane in a little while, but we'll come on to that. So the corpse needs a backstory. It needs to be good. So they choose the name for the corpse, as we'll call him, they choose Captain Acting Major William Martin. So it's Major Bill Martin of the Royal Marines. They choose the name Martin because when they looked at the Royal Marines register, there were lots of Martins of that rank. The other reason they decided he should be a Royal Marine is that they wear battle dress when travelling and it would be easy for them to come by in uniform.
Right, right.
And the acting major rank meant that he was senior enough to be carrying the messages, but not so senior that the Germans would expect to know him.
So much to think about.
So much to think about. And I mean, I'm leaving a lot out of this. Yeah. Read the book, because there's a lot more detail. To reinforce the backstory, the team have to produce what in intelligence circles is known as wallet litter or pocket litter.
Okay.
And that's the stuff that, you know, it would be weird if a body floated up and all it had on it was these important documents and nothing else.
Yes.
You know, because we all carry shit with us all the time. You know? So they concocted this whole story around him. There was a woman called Jean Leslie who worked in Room 13 with Montagu. And they put a photograph of her in the wallet as Pam, who was Bill's fiance, right? And in the picture, she's been swimming. So it was like a swimsuit shot, which was quite saucy for the time.
So somebody had to go up to Jean in the office and go, could we have a picture of you in your swimsuit, please, young lady?
Look, she actually supplied it. They basically asked all the women, can you give us some photographs?
I bet they did.
Yeah, not all of them in swimsuits. And all the women that worked in Room 13 were beautiful because that was part of their recruitment strategy because... Uncle John Godfrey, who was the head of Naval Intelligence, he said that beautiful women were less likely to boast to their boyfriends about what they were doing.
Yeah, he just wanted some totty around, didn't he?
Right, exactly. So in order to get this wallet litter, the team at Room 13, they had a bit of a fun time. They would go to nightclubs, go to bars, so they could get receipts for the things to put
it's
in the wallet.
Effort,
right?
It's for the war effort, sir. It's for the war effort. We employ pretty girls, we go to nightclubs. It's all part of our intelligence gathering service.
Exactly. They also wrote love letters. There were two love letters in there from Pam.
Oh, God. So did Montagu write these letters?
Yes.
So he had to pretend to be a woman. Right?
Well, it gets weirder.
Okay.
So Jean Leslie is this woman who is now Pam.
Yeah.
And Ewan Montagu plays the part of Bill in the letters that they write to each other. But they start actually going out together on dates as Bill and Pam.
Okay.
And it becomes this... Remember, he's married, but his wife has now been in America. He hasn't seen his wife for about 3 years. And it's never actually said that they were having a sexual affair.
But they start to
call
each other Bill and Pam and everything.
They start to call each other Bill and Pam. And they are still writing to each other as Bill and Pam nearly five decades after the war has ended.
Okay, there's something going on there, Angela.
His mother, Lady Swathling, wrote to his wife in America saying, I'm a bit... You want to keep an eye on your husband? I think he's getting a bit close to this... woman in his office.
I'd love to have read the letter from Jean, though.
You can read them in the book. They're in the book. And they sort of had a bit too much fun with it.
Okay.
In that, in places, it came a bit too close to being like, oh, come on. Because she wrote in this really melodramatic way, Pam, which was sort of fashionable at the time, you know, like romance novels and things.
Yes.
But she would write things like, I've got such a foreboding feeling that I won't see you again. It's like, don't write that.
You might say, I hope you don't crash in your plane off Spain. That would be awful.
Oh, that would be terrible. They also put in a letter from Martin's pompous father, and they created this backstory that he owed the bank loads of money, and so that his father was angry with him and things like that.
If he's in the water, would you not be able to read these bloody letters anyway?
Well, so Montagu has thought of this, right? The ink gets washed away in the water. So he got some MI5 scientists to conduct tests on different types of ink to see which lasted longer in the water.
That's the less glamorous bit. So one load of them had to go to nightclubs. That's our job. You, down in the end of the corridor, your guy is to go to the bogs with salt water and just put ink in the sink. That's your job for the week.
Exactly. They needed the items in the wallet litter as well, had a function of not just being there to be there, but also to construct a bit of an itinerary for him.
Yeah.
So on the 22nd of April, there was a famous comedian at the time called Sid Field, who was playing in London. He was touring at the time. He was playing in London on the 22nd of April. And his support act, you know who his support act was?
Tell me.
A young Morecambe and Wise.
Oh, God, how old were they back then?
They would have been 16, 17.
They were playing. They were playing. So that Morecambe and Wise have a little walk-on part in this amazing story.
They do.
The comics I watched as a kid, they were... sort of attached to this story of wartime subterfuge and spies. Amazing. Well.
So you and Montagu and Pam, not Pam, Jean, and Chumley and someone else, I think one of the other women from the office, he buys four tickets for this show.
Okay.
And they all go to the show, actually, on the night. Of course they bloody do. But in the meantime, so he buys them in advance because we're still, you know, we're not in April yet. Because they need it to look like he'd been in London on the 22nd of April.
Right.
And other things, there's like a book of stamps, silver cross, St. Christopher's, medallions, cigarettes, matches, pencil stub keys, and a receipt from Jeeves?
I don't know, for a new shirt. The cross, I think, the silver cross was to make him a Catholic. And yes. They thought his body would be treated with more reverence by the Spanish if he was a Catholic.
Yeah, and they'd be less likely to do a full autopsy.
Right.
If he was Catholic in a Catholic country.
Good thinking.
The other thing they needed was an ID card.
Okay.
Now, it's pretty tricky, John, to take a photo of a corpse's face and make it look like it isn't dead.
Can't say I've ever tried.
So they tried, but obviously it was just a photo of a dead man.
Yeah.
So they had to find someone. So they did a search and there was a Captain Ronnie Reed of MI5 who apparently was a spitting image for the corpse, which I'm not sure how you tell someone that.
Right.
But he was. And he agreed to be photographed for the ID card wearing a Royal Marine uniform.
Despite having a normal name.
Ronnie Reed, that could be a builder, couldn't it?
He's a snooker player, isn't it? It's like, what are you doing in this story? Your name isn't Sir Montague Chomley Farquharson. You should get out of this story immediately.
So actually, several ID cards were made and it was up to the submarine captain at the end of the day to choose which one to put on the body at the time.
Okay.
But Montague would carry them in his wallet and would occasionally rub them on his trousers to try and make them look nice and worn.
Oh, yeah. Didn't he wear the uniform as well?
Chomley. That was Chomley who did. Because Chomley was 6'3", as was Glendour. So he would wear the uniform around the place to make it look worn in.
It's a bit creepy, isn't it? I'm wearing the clothes that a dead man's going to be dumped in.
Yeah. But again, wartime, John.
Wartime, got to do
different
it.
Different rules. Now, the important thing that this corpse is going to be carrying are the deception documents, right?
Yes. So, yes, absolutely.
And this is where it gets really tricky, because it's not just a case of going, let's just put some wartime plans in his briefcase, because the Germans would know if a man of his rank was carrying something he shouldn't be carrying. So the deception is, and the Operation Barclay's whole deception was that they would make it look like their plans were to attack the Balkans via Greece.
Yep.
And that Sicily was a cover. Right.
Now,
because in reality they were attacking Sicily,
they
needed a reason for
stuff going on there.
Stuff going on there as well.
That's just to fool us. I've got the letter.
So when they were actually building up to attack Sicily, they make the Germans think that that was just their decoy.
Yeah, yeah. So they could, because they would get other intelligence information. So they wrote a letter saying, we're definitely attacking Greece and not Sicily. Honest.
Honest Gov.
In German.
Signed a real person.
This is sophisticated stuff.
So the other thing they decided was it should be unofficial correspondence, because he wouldn't be carrying official correspondence.
Right,
official
right.
correspondence would have been in a diplomatic bag or encrypted signal. So they didn't want the Germans to question why he was carrying it.
Yeah.
So the main deception document was a personal letter from Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Nye, who was the Vice Chief of the Imperial General Staff.
Right.
And he was writing a letter to General Sir Harold Alexander, who was the commander of the Anglo-American 18th Army Group in Algeria and Tunisia under Eisenhower. Because obviously they're all in North Africa and they've just won the North African campaign, and that's where they're launching the attack on Sicily from. But drafting these letters, John, reading about the drafting of these letters reminded me of trying to get a sitcom made, where there were just too many people looking at it
and
with
their
own
notes.
Ideas of what it should be and giving you conflicting notes.
Oh, what a nightmare. I've been there. God, yeah.
We've all been there.
Oh, notes from the production company, notes from the BBC comedy, notes from the head of BBC. That's before you even get the actor saying, I don't think my character would do this.
So you know as a writer that everyone's got their own ideas of what should go in it. And ultimately, when you try and incorporate everyone's ideas, it
doesn't work.
Ruins it. And Johnny Bevan, who's the head of Operation Barclay, and Montague, who's heading up Operation Mincemeat, they don't get on very well.
Oh,
right?
No.
So Johnny Bevan is anything he can do to criticise what they're doing, he will. So he's making their job quite difficult. So in the end, what they did, they got Nye, who was the person who allegedly had written the letter, to actually write it. So it would they brought him in on it to a certain extent and got him to write it. So they knew it would be in his voice and it would be the sort of things that he would say because he was writing it.
If the spies had had anything else from him, they'd recognise the style as being consistent as well.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, good, good, good.
So he wrote this letter and the most important part was, we have recent information that the Boche have been reinforcing and strengthening their defences in Greece and Crete. And CIGS felt that, that's the chief of the Imperial General Staff.
I like how you kept your accent for that. That was good. The brackets. Yes. Chief of the Imperial General Staff. Sorry, do continue, Angela.
Felt that our forces for the assault were insufficient. It was agreed by the Chiefs of Staff that the 5th Division should be reinforced by one brigade group for the assault on the beach south of Cape Araxos, i.e. Greece, and that a similar reinforcement should be made for the 56th Division at Kalamata.
Yeah, and the
Greece.
Germans reading this going, hang on. This
hang
doesn't
on
sound
a minute,
very
that's
Sicilian.
Not Sicily.
I've been to Sicily. There's nothing, no X's in their place names. Yeah.
The second deception document he carried was a letter from Vice Admiral Louis Mountbatten, cousin of the Queen, because he was the commander of the Royal Marines, so he would have been the commanding officer of the corps. And it was a letter to the Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Andrew Cunningham, who was the Allied naval commander in the Mediterranean. Martin's cover was, that's the corps, was referred to in the letter as an amphibious warfare expert on loan until the assault is over. Ah. So it's Mountbatten is sending him there with the documents and to be an expert in the field.
Okay.
Also in the letter, which has been written by Montague, this one, signed by Montgomery, but Montague wrote it. And in it, he put a clumsy joke about sardines. I can't remember what it was. Something like, oh, I hope you bring some sardines back with you. In the hope that the Germans would read that as a hint that they were also going to launch an attack on Sardinia.
When they'd finished laughing about the sardines.
When they'd finished laughing at the hilarious sardines joke. In the letter, the deception documents, they also placed a single black eyelash.
So that
when the letters were returned, they'd be able to tell if they'd been read or not.
This has got to be an Ian Fleming touch. That's got to be, because in Bond, there is actually a thing where he has a single hair he puts in a door or something, or in a wardrobe. And
I think it was a common thing, because Fleming's not involved in mincemeat at all.
I know, but I just want to make it more glamorous.
I know it's more glamorous that way. So now it's what to do with the documents. The original plan was they'd slide the documents into his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that is because of this Roman Catholic aversion to tampering with corpses, which is good in terms of it means they might not do a full autopsy. It's not good if they don't search him at all, because then they're never going to find the documents, right? And they could be missed. So they decide instead he should carry them in an official briefcase.
Okay. Wasn't he going to drop that?
Two problems with that. One is, why would you have a briefcase with just two letters in? That's going to look dodgy. So they had to find other stuff to fill the briefcase up with. So they filled it up with some copies of pamphlets and some other letters and bits and bobs.
Waterways World magazine. Is that just me?
Yeah, that's right. That's just you, John. But also, as you say, with a briefcase, you can't rely on rigor mortis to keep the briefcase attached to the corpse.
Not.
So what they did, they attached it with a leather-covered chain, like a bank and jewellery couriers
That sounds a bit dodgy to me. I think I'd be a bit suspicious if I saw that attached to his arm.
Well, yes and no. I mean, he is carrying sensitive information, so it might make sense. But what Montague did think was unlikely, that if he'd been on a plane, which the idea is he's, been in a plane crash, that he's unlikely to have stayed chained to the briefcase on the plane.
Okay.
So they just changed it to his overcoat.
Okay. Yeah, all right. I'll go with it.
Yeah. There's several things, John, that in this you think, how did they not pick up on that? But I think you have to remember that also the Germans are quite paranoid at this stage in the war, and they want this information to be accurate.
True.
Because they want to be able to act on it,
I got it.
But I think we'll take a little break now while the plan's being finalised.
Are we only at half time?
We're only at half time, John, and you're going to go and make a Bentley purchase, aren't you?
My name is Purchase. Bentley Purchase. Hello and welcome back to part two of We Are History. We have this running battle. We have this running battle. I'm going, Angela, your plan is longer than War and Peace. It's like,
but I think listeners don't mind if it's over an hour long, if it's interesting, right?
Right, okay. Well,
and I think this is interesting.
It is
honestly
interesting.
John, if you read the book that I read, Ben McIntyre's Operation Mincemeat, it would be there's so much fascinating stuff in there that I've had to leave out.
I just don't think the podcast should be longer than the war it's talking about.
But at least people will be able to tell by the length of the podcast which ones I've researched and which ones you've researched.
True. Mine are like, back of a bag packet, scribble down the key points.
Yeah, he's moaning about time and he spends the first 5 minutes of the second half berating me for how long it is.
I think what we have to do, if you go over the hour, you have to do another 500 sit-ups, for the Royal Marsden. Angela is doing this. About a million sit-ups for the Royal Marsden.
3,000
sit-ups. I gave her 50p towards it. So listeners, go on the
It's on my Twitter, Angela Barnes. It's the pinned tweet, and it is my friend's very poorly at the moment, and the Royal Marsden have been looking after him. And so I'm just doing this thing. It's 3,000 sit-ups in March. So I'm doing basically 100 sit-ups a day. And I still don't look like, you know, I thought I'd have a six-pack by now, John.
You'd have a six-pack.
Hasn't happened.
But you've got to keep doing them in April and May if you don't make your podcast shorter. That's the new rule. Yeah.
But anyway, talking about this podcast being too long. You could have done this in the last podcast, John. You could have done this in the last one that you led that was 40 minutes. But no, you've decided to make my one that is too long even bloody longer. Should we go back to the story?
Yes, Spain. Take us back to Spain,
Angela. So the plan's finalised, what they're going to do. So now it's all about when they do it and how they actually carry out the job. So they select, the place they select for the body to wash up is a place called Huelva, which is on the coast of southern Spain. And it's selected because they consulted with a naval hydrographer on where the body's most likely to wash ashore with the winds and the tides and everything else. And also they knew that in Huelva, in this city, there was a German agent who was very active, because obviously the body needs to wash up somewhere where there was a network of German spies.
Right.
And this particular spy, his name was Adolf Klaus, which is what you want a spy to be called, isn't it?
He's central casting Nazi, isn't he?
Absolutely.
My name is Adolf Klaus. I'm a Nazi.
He was a member of the Abwehr, which is, as we said, the intelligence agency.
Right.
And he was the son of the German consul in Huelva.
Mm-hmm.
And he operated under the cover of being an agricultural technician. But he had literally everyone in that town in his pay. Like all the harbour masters, local politicians, farmers, just loads of people were being paid to give him information. And also in Huelva, the British vice consul there was a man called Francis Hazeldon. And Montague knew of him and knew that he would be a helpful person in the operation. So that's why they chose that place. Now, originally, they were thinking, well, you can't just have a body wash up and there's no crash. Like, somebody would hear an air crash or see debris
or
something.
Could have been out at sea, I suppose.
Well, exactly. What they decided in the end, because they toyed with the idea of sort of smashing up a plane or letting flares off or whatever.
Right.
But in the end, they decided there'd be no wreckage or explosion. And that actually, in wartime, the Germans aren't going to look too hard. They'd just be satisfied that any debris sunk or drifted away or whatever.
I'm buying it.
They decided the best way to get the body to the waters where it had to be deposited was by submarine.
Wow.
Okay, so there's a submarine called HMS Seraph. It was captained by a man called Bill Jewell. And Bill Jewell is just this hard nut submarine captain. Like, submariners are hard and tough, right? It's a bonkers life being a submariner. He was such a hard man that he broke two vertebrae in his neck during the war and just hadn't noticed. And conducted the whole war with a broken neck, right? Which was only discovered years later. The next thing to do is get permission from the Prime Minister and from General Eisenhower. So by this point, this body's been in the morgue since the 29th of January. Right? Yeah. 15th of April, John Bevan, who was the head of the London Controlling Section overseeing Operation Barclay, he goes to meet Churchill in the Cabinet War Offices, who is in bed wearing a dressing gown and smoking a cigar, which is how you imagine.
Yeah.
He did most of his stuff from bed, didn't he? He spent a lot of time in bed. He warned Churchill that there were some aspects that could go wrong. For example, it was quite likely that the Spaniards would just give the corpse back to Britain with the papers unread, because the Spanish Navy were quite pro-British.
Okay.
Different elements in Spain were different, loyalties.
Yeah.
Churchill's response to that was, in that case, we shall have to get the body back and give it another swim.
See, I don't think that was a very good Churchill impression.
I'll hand that over to you.
In that case, we shall have to get the body back and give it another swim.
No. Oh, no, wrong Churchill.
Yes.
So Churchill gave his approval to the operation. He said, Oh, yes. We've gone giddy, John, have you noticed? And on the 17th of April, Eisenhower's approval was given. So we're going. Operation Mincemeat is go. As soon as Eisenhower's given his approval, they start moving, right? So that morning, Montague and Cholmondeley, they go to the mortuary at St. Pancras to prepare the corpse for his role.
Yep.
In this. So they dress him in his Royal Marine battle dress. They've got a little bit of a problem, John, with the feet.
Oh, no, what?
Because his feet are frozen, and it was impossible to get his boots on at that angle. And obviously they can't, they have to put the boots on him because his feet are rotten. So the Montague finds an electric heater, melts his frozen feet.
Oh, God, this, it's not as glamorous, is it, as James
it's really
Bond is,
not.
Is it?
And you by got... all accounts, this was pretty grim. I mean, he's been, you know, he's not been frozen, so he's been still decomposing, although it's slower.
Yeah.
So now the corpse of poor old Glyndwr Michael, the man nobody gave a shit about, is now dressed as Major Bill Martin.
Yeah.
And they place the pocket litter on him and they attach the briefcase to his overcoat. Now, the question is, how do you get the corpse to the submarine? The submarine is in Scotland.
Well, that's the wrong way for a start.
It's off Scotland. It's the wrong way. So before this, Cholmondeley, he has, with advice from this pathologist, remember old Bernard Spilsbury?
Yeah.
The pathologist. They commissioned Charles Fraser Smith of Kew Branch, who is likely one of the people that Fleming based Kew on.
Right.
They commissioned him to devise a canister for transporting the body. Now, obviously, his body's got a long journey. Right, yeah. It's got to get from London to Scotland, then Scotland to Spain on a submarine. So they've got to stop it decomposing on the submarine. So this canister they've designed is packed with dry ice, right?
Wow.
Which when sublimated, so when it goes from solid to gas without there being a liquid state,
yeah,
it will fill the canister with carbon dioxide and drive out any oxygen so he won't decompose. Right? So he's packed into this canister with dry ice, and it's sealed up, and it's marked "handle with care, optical instruments." Right, ooh. And the cover for the canister for it going on the submarine and everything else is that it was meteorological instruments being transported.
Well said. You said that. Pronounce that quite
thanks,
well.
Me. Eventually, so now they need to recruit a driver, and they do. They recruit not any old driver. He's an MI5 chauffeur. But he was a famous racing driver. His name was Jock Horsfall. And he'd been a champion racing driver before the war, right?
Right.
Won all these cups and things. And he had this 1937 Fordson van.
Okay.
So they put the canister in the back of that, with Cholmondeley and Montague also in the back with the canister.
Up
the Great North Road, off to Scotland, right? Now, not only is Jock Horsfall famous for being a racing driver, he's famous for being an incredibly short-sighted racing driver who refuses to wear glasses. So they've got this short-sighted, speedy driver. Yeah, and it needs to be quick. They need to get there quickly because the captain of the submarine has said they have to depart by midday. Okay. They've only got the go-ahead in the early hours of the morning. So he's belting up to Scotland. And by all accounts, the journey was pretty hairy. They nearly drove into a tram stop at one point. He was driving over roundabouts. And of course, they've got their headlights masked as well because it's
blackout. Of course, it's blackout, yeah.
Luckily, there wasn't much other traffic on the road. And then they get him to Scotland. They get to the submarine. And what they've done is they've taken one of the torpedoes out of the torpedo reload rack on the submarine and they put him in the torpedo rack in the canister, right? Now, on a submarine, there are more men than there are bunks to sleep in, right? So they do sort of hotbed system where, you know, you have different shifts. But there's still not quite enough beds. So quite often, the men sleep in the torpedo racks.
Okay,
and so these men were sleeping next to this body without knowing that's what it was.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Although some of them had an idea. It was a slightly body-sized canister. So they, you know, some of them were like, really? So he's on his way now. It's the 17th of April and he's on his way. And he won't get to the waters where he's going to be deposited till late April, like the 29th, 30th.
Yeah.
On the 22nd of April, while he's on his journey, Montague and Cholmondeley are like, our work is done. We just got to see how it plays out now. They decide to have a farewell party for Major Bill Martin. And that's the night they go to see the comedy show and they have a big party.
They have a great night out.
Oh, they have a brilliant time.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
28th of April, the submarine Seraph is starting to approach Huelva.
Yes.
So Bill Jewell, he has the canister brought up on deck. Then he sends all his crew below, except for the officers, at which point he tells them what's in the canister. Right? Because at this point, Bill Jewell's the only one who knows. But obviously, he can't haul up the canister and empty the body out by himself.
Right.
They open the container, and by all accounts, it's pretty grim. And also, what's happened is, while the dry ice has worked to a certain extent, where he's got pockets of air in his clothes, the oxygen hasn't escaped. So he has continued to rot a bit more.
Oh, God, okay.
So it's a pretty smelly, pretty grim job getting his body out of the canister and lowered into the water. But as they did it, Bill Jewell read Psalm 39, which I thought was quite a nice sort of, you know, they wanted to give him some dignity in what they were doing. They had a few issues before they actually got the body into the water, because there were fishing boats around and stuff, and they had to make sure they couldn't
see. Oh, yeah, of course.
But eventually they did it. The next job was go back out to sea and sink the canister so it would never be found. So they went about 12 miles away, get the canister up, surface the submarine, push it into the water, and the bloody thing floats.
Oh, no.
No. So they're like, okay, well, what we'll do, we'll shoot it with machine guns, and then it'll fill with water and it'll sink. So they riddled it with machine gun fire, but because of air trapped in it, it still floated.
Why don't they just take it back with them? It seems a bit of making things.
Well, I suppose if they got intercepted, if they got torpedoed or whatever, and it get found, you know, anything that would make the Germans question what was happening. So what they did in the end, they hauled it back onto the boat, filled it with plastic explosives.
Right.
They put it out to sea and exploded it in the sea. And of course, this explosion would have been heard by people. But again, it's wartime. Right?
Could have been the plane going down.
It could have been a plane going down. And they thought any debris from it would be so shattered, people would just assume it was debris from a plane or whatever. And Bill Jewell didn't tell anyone that they'd blown it up with plastic explosives until 1991.
Wow.
He sent a message to the Admiralty that simply said, mincemeat completed. Right.
Very straightforward.
So Major Martin now is on his way. And sure enough, he washes up on the beach, John, at 9:30 a.m. on the 30th of April, 1943, where he's found by a local fisherman called Jose Antonio Rey Maria.
Yep, local boy.
Good Spanish name, that, isn't
it? Yes, yeah.
And there was some local Spanish soldiers doing drills. So the fisherman ran to them and went, you'll never guess what I've just found. And they hauled the body onto a donkey, which was then led by a child into the town of Huelva.
Blimey, most interesting thing to happen in Huelva for a bit.
Right. The body was handed straight over to a naval judge. Now, the vice consul, remember this was Sir Francis Hazeldon, who Montague knew. He's waiting for this to happen, right? He's been prepared that this is going to happen. So he gets the call and he's officially informed and told that the Admiralty have the body in the briefcase.
So he has to pretend to demand it and pretend to be really worried about this.
Exactly. Now, this is where it gets really tricky, right? Because he has to look like he really wants the briefcase, but he doesn't.
But if they go, okay then, all right, you can have it. No, I insist you don't look at the material.
Which is exactly what happens. Is right? The naval judge offers the briefcase straight to him. You're the vice consul of Britain. You're British. This is a British body because the Navy are quite pro-British. Yeah. So he says, do you just want to take the briefcase then? So Francis Hazelden has to go, actually, no, I think it should go through the proper channels.
Yes, that's a diplomat.
And actually got away with that. So it very nearly all fell apart at the first hurdle there. So the briefcase is now separated from the body and goes off to the naval authorities and starts making its way to Madrid, right, to the naval command. So they then do an autopsy on the body. Yeah. Now, it turns out that old Spilsforth was wrong. Like, they do know how to do autopsies in Spain. They do have quite good doctors. But what Hazelden does is, it's a really hot day and this is a stinking body.
Oh, yeah.
And he's there with the pathologist as they're doing the autopsy. And of course, it's a British, you know, he's a British vice consul. It's a British body. So he sort of says to the pathologist, do you want to wrap it up, lads, and we can all go for lunch? Because it's a bit hot and smelly in here, isn't it? And, you know, the Spanish, John, being all about a siesta. They're not bothered. So they just agreed, signed the death certificate, asphyxiation through immersion in the sea.
We're done here.
They then released the body and he was able to have a burial. And it's quite moving, this, I think, because he has this burial as Major Martin in the San Marco section of the Nuestra Senora Cemetery in Huelva, full military honours on the 2nd of May. And there's something poignant about that, isn't it? Something that Michael himself would never have had a decent burial. He would have had a pauper's grave.
He said to his parents, he's going to be buried in a Spanish military funeral. They would have been like, well, how the hell does he end up doing that? The story is too fantastical to imagine.
But he had no family that cared, no family that knew. No. His family weren't informed about any of this because they couldn't find them. They didn't, you know, he was dead. Yeah. They didn't know anything about it. So remember Adolf Klaus, the German spy? He gets wind of this body and there's a briefcase, right? He knows there's a briefcase and he's desperate to see what's inside it. Yeah. Especially as they'd pre-planned that Hazard and the vice consul would send these like desperate messages back to England.
Yeah.
About having to get the briefcase that they knew the Germans would intercept. So they have to look like they're desperately trying to get the briefcase, even though they're actually not. And Klaus has got these intercepted messages and he's like, right, there's something in that briefcase they don't want us to see. We want to see it. The Spanish Navy have retained the briefcase, but they're more sympathetic to the Allies, like we said. So it's the one branch of the military or anything really in Huelva where Klaus hasn't got that covered. So the briefcase gets sent to Madrid. The contents were photographed, including by German agents, but they were too scared to open the letters, John, because they were sealed with a wax seal. So it's like, if you open, they're going to know they've been opened. So the most senior German agent in Spain was a man called Karl Erich Kuhlenthal. Now, he had a secret, and his secret was that his grandmother was Jewish. So he had a real vested interest in telling the Nazis whatever they wanted to hear. So Hitler really trusted him and he would write these amazing florid accounts of things. He would embellish things. He would. So he was an ideal person to get this information because he wasn't going to question anything. He wanted it to be right. He wanted it to be good intelligence so much that he was willing to overlook certain things like there wasn't a crash or things like that. So the Spanish authorities, they managed to find a way in the end in Madrid to get the letters out of the envelopes without breaking the seal.
Okay.
Because the gum on the envelopes had dissolved.
In the water.
And so they were able to get like a probe in between the bits of the envelope, roll the letter around the probe and pull it out of the hole.
Okay. I won't try and understand that.
Let's just say they didn't notice that the eyelash fell out of the letter as well.
Okay. That's good.
So they dried the letters, photographed them, and then they re-soaked them in salt water for 24 hours and then put them back in the envelopes and dried them.
Yeah.
And this information did make it to the Germans. On the 8th of May, Kuhlenthal personally takes the documents to Berlin.
So it's worked like a treat. It's worked
like
a treat.
It has worked like a charm. And so on the 11th of May, the briefcase, complete with all the documents and everything, is returned to Hazelden and then returned to London by diplomatic bag. So as far as the Germans are aware, the British think they haven't seen it, which is really important, right? Because if they think the British know that they know, the British are going to change their plans, right?
Yeah.
So as far as the Germans are aware, the Allies have got no idea that they've got this information. But what the British don't know yet, until they get the bag, is whether the Germans have got it. They know the Spanish have read it because they know the letters have been opened.
Yes.
But they don't know until they intercept some signals traffic later on that the Germans... it has been passed from the Spanish to the Germans.
That was my dad's job, intercepting the German intelligence. Yeah, he was.
Is it Bletchley?
No, it wasn't a Bletchley, but he listened to the Morse code and wrote them all down. That was his job. So maybe this came across my dad's desk. Who knows?
May well have done. May well have done. Just in case the Germans did any more digging to find out more about Major Martin, they put his death in the published list of British casualties in the Times on the 4th of June.
Oh, nice touch. Nice touch. They would have looked at the Times. Oh, look, there he is. See, told you. Yeah. Told you it's true. It's in the Times. It must be true.
There were some doubts in German quarters. Like, where's the crash site? Where are the other bodies? Presumably he wasn't on his own in this plane. But these reports from Kuhlenthal are very persuasive because he wants them to believe him. And Hitler really likes him. And Hitler, at this point, he needs some good news, right?
So he's predisposed to receiving it.
Yeah, the war is really going against the Germans. They've lost North Africa.
They've lost Stalingrad.
They've lost Stalingrad. He needs some good news. Yeah. And also, it really was useful whose desks this information came across, that it came across Kuhlenthal's desk. Also, that in Germany, in Berlin, the people there assessing the intelligence, one of them was a man called von Werner, who, again, Hitler was a big fan of his, but he was actually a German monarchist and he hated the Nazis and the Bolsheviks, but he really hated the Nazis, although he was working for them. And so he would routinely inflate what the Allies were doing.
Okay, okay.
So he was keen also to validate it for Hitler.
Yeah.
By the end of June, sure enough, German troop strength on Sardinia, because they fell for the sardines joke, John.
Oh, it's a good... See, power of satire. They say you can't change anything with jokes, but...
But
the
hey,
the course
you
of
can.
World War II was changed with a sardine pun.
So they start reinforcing troops on Sardinia and reinforcing troops in Greece and the Balkans.
Wow.
It's worked.
So it works,
right?
A treat. Yeah.
And on 9th of July, 1943, the Allies invade Sicily in Operation Husky.
And everyone's going, ah, oh, it's a decoy, it's a decoy. Hitler's going, no, we knew we were going to, they're pretending to invade Sicily.
And for quite a considerable time after that initial invasion, Hitler was still convinced that the attack on the Balkans was imminent. He
right,
still kept
coming.
Reinforcements. He was convinced
kept
it was
his stuff
coming.
In Greece. You would think that invading Sicily was like a slightly dodgy choice, wouldn't it? With a sort of, we have some Sicilians back in New York and we try not to upset those guys.
Yeah, they can be a little...
They've got guns of their own, you know. Have you seen The Godfather? So, the invasion of Sicily is a success because it's under-defended.
That's it. By the time the German high command realise what's happened, it's too late to make a difference.
Then they're onto the mainland from Sicily. They hop off onto the toe of Italy.
Yeah.
Anything I'll say about all this, Andrew, it's very interesting. It's a very good podcast. But I would say that whenever there's a story like this, and they say, and it's turned the entire history of the war, I would say the invasion of Italy, you know, was not the most important thing in the war. Stalingrad, D-Day, you know, Battle for the Pacific. But the invasion of Sicily was important. But
butterfly effect, John. We don't know, do we?
We don't know.
And the other thing is as well, you know, we don't know for sure that it was Operation Mincemeat that sealed the deal. There were other operations going on. You know, there was the whole of Operation Barclay had a numerous ways of trying to convince the Germans of the same thing. So it might be that Mincemeat just corroborated what they were already thinking.
Sure. Well, that's clever.
But it's an interesting story. And
it's a great story.
I just think that this chap in life could never have known what in death he was going to achieve.
His greatest achievement was as a corpse, which is not a great... You know.
It's not. And Ewan Montague wrote something to that effect in his diaries, which was a little bit upsetting, you know, that this man was basically nothing in life but a hero in death.
And Montague wrote a memoir about it, didn't he?
He did. The Man Who Never Was.
They made a film.
Made a film of it, and in which Montague made a cameo as an air vice marshal. And there's a lovely picture in the book of a still from the film. And there's Clifton Webb, who's playing Ewan Montague, sat opposite Ewan Montague.
So The Man Who Never Was was quite a famous film in the 50s. Mm. But it was only quite recently, I think, that it came out that it was Glyndi and Michael. I think that came out in the 90s or something, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they didn't. Yeah. They kept his identity secret for a long time. I suppose in case he might have still had sisters and things alive. I don't know if they were protected. I don't know.
I think we should dedicate this podcast to Glyndi and Michael.
Definitely.
Say thank you. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, sorry your life was so shit.
Shit, but you made a difference to World War II. You turned the tide of World War II.
Indeed.
On your own.
Indeed. We'll and do read the Operation Mincemeat book. I know this was a long podcast, John.
I didn't notice it was long, actually. Did I mention that you're...
I'm giving John the finger right now, everyone. Ben McIntyre writes really accessibly about these sort of... His book, The Spy and the Traitor, is really good. Agent Zigzag, he wrote about Eddie, what's his name? And Agent Sonia is his latest, which I haven't read yet.
Splendid.
Really good.
Well, thank you, Ben McIntyre. Thank you, Glyndi and Michael. Thank you, Angela Barnes, for informing me about Operation Mincemeat and The Man Who Never Was. Thank you, Spike, for getting Angela's four-hour monologue down to the hour that we'll be going out. We'll be back next week with another thrilling instalment of We Are History Pod. Tell us if you're enjoying them on Twitter. If you're not enjoying them, don't say anything. And make sure you give us 5 stars and a good review on iTunes, because that helps our
really
algorithms.
Yes, whatever they may be.
Bye.
Bye.